Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Today, we're sharing recent author interviews for our Summer Reads Hanaho Show. We look at a book that tells the untold story of Hawaii's punk scene and the rebellious lifestyle that comes with it. We pause to appreciate the Ohia Tree in a keiki book that teaches readers about the flora and fauna of Hawaii's forests. Can you do magic? If you speak your native tongue, you can in this author's debut novel, A Magical Murder Mystery. And we highlight the work of the women fighting for food sovereignty across Hawaii and New Zealand. Go ahead, curl up in your favorite spot. You might find a new title to add to your book bag. It's Aloha Friday, July 24th. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. We have put together a Summer Reads book list for you on today's Hanaho Show. We start in the heyday of the Honolulu punk scene. Being a punk in Hawaii comes at a cost. Just ask Speedy Lopez, whose memories of the scene includes getting jumped outside of bars. That's the kind of action you'll find in his book, Local Unrest, which explores the true story of Hawaii's punk rock music scene. Lopez interviewed more than 100 people to compile a far-ranging oral history. He talked to The Conversation's Kevin Allen back in February.
I've always been interested in music, and you know, half my jobs have been music-related, so I would always read these books about different music scenes, you know, the New York hardcore punk scene, the L.A. underground rock scene, the Minneapolis rock scene, and it always got me thinking, you know, well, what were the origins of our scene here in Hawaii? I mean, we've got the same kind of music. I mean, we have bands that made it to the top, you know, made it to major labels. I mean, nobody's told that story. So, you know, maybe I should try and figure this out and hunt the people down and get that story on paper.
And, you know, in the book, I think it's really interesting, too, because at the kind of at the front, you talk about how, you know, punk in most other cities is a counterculture thing, right? It's not the norm. And especially in Hawaii, I think that is doubly true, where a lot of Hawaiiana music was really popular at the time, and where Hawaiiana is clean, punk is about as dirty as it can get. I mean, you know, back in the day, how did it feel being a punk and really, I mean, really not fitting in with the culture at the time?
Yeah, there's a humorous part in this book where me and a friend who grew up in Kalihi, we're talking about how there were no punk rock kids back in those days, right? I mean, he actually said, I think you were the only kid in Kalihi who actually listened to punk rock back in the 80s, you know, like early, at least in the early 80s or so. And I thought about it. I was like, you know what? You're right. I don't think there were any other kids in our neighborhood that listened to it. So, I mean, I was okay with that. You know, we're kind of outsiders. My friends were like heavy metal headbangers, so they were kind of outsiders as well. So we kind of gravitated to each other, you know, we sort of related. And eventually they got turned on to punk rock as well through skateboarding, because that's sort of a parallel sort of pastime, you know. And I think a lot of people got turned on to punk rock through skateboarding, which really exploded in the 80s.
Absolutely. And I think it's really cool too in the book, you know, you kind of talk about, you know, these waves, the first big punk bands here kind of start emerging, the Squids and all these old names that, you know, maybe a lot of people don't even know about today anymore.
Yeah, that was really exciting for me, like as a young teenager or even as a preteen, I would hear these bands and kind of follow them from afar, right? So I'd known about the Squids, even though I was in elementary school, basically, when they were big, you know, and a lot of these other bands that would come later. And then as a teenager, obviously, I'd get to sneak out of the house and start going to gigs and stuff. So that was really exciting to know that there are kids that are your age, maybe a little older, that were in bands, and you could actually do that yourself, right? I think that's the biggest appeal of punk rock is you can just go out and get a guitar, learn three or four chords with your friends, and you can have a band right away. You don't have to woodshed for years and until you become a guitar virtuoso. You can do it today if you wanted to.
And I think it's really interesting, too. You kind of talk about, in the book, a lot of these really, I don't want to say nefarious, but my goodness, the scene back in the 70s and 80s, it just was so much less regulated. There was a lot more raw, rough things happening. Talk to me about that, just about what it was like back in that time.
Yeah, I mean, hearing these stories from the older kids about what would happen at some of these clubs, I mean, you got to remember the drinking age did not change to 21 until maybe the mid to late 80s. So up until then, you could be 18 and go into a club legally. But most clubs, you know, if you looked the part, if you were like 15 or 16, you had a mustache, I mean, they'd let you in, you know? And I think a lot of the older people sort of from the scene back in the day kind of look at that as being the good old days.
Researching this book and doing the interviews, you must have heard a lot of stories about the good old days. What did you learn anything maybe, I guess, new or that you didn't know about when you were researching and writing this book?
I think the most shocking thing for me was like just the level of violence that occurred back then, you know, like that was a little bit surprising to me. I mean, in this book, you'll come across a, you know, there's a murder that happened that involved a nightclub owner. There were several shootings. Someone died in front of one of the nightclubs. A couple of doormen got shot at nightclubs here. And it's all in the book. I think a lot of people tend to look at the old days and think of them as the good old days where things were safer, but it's not necessarily true, you know? I mean, in my research, I found out that 1980 was actually probably the worst year in terms of murder here in Hawaii. And people wonder why, but you got to remember that there weren't security cameras on every block back then. The gun laws were a lot more lax, right? And I think bad people could get away with things a lot easier than they can today. So, yeah, there's a lot of violence in here, and it's pretty interesting. And I was shocked to come across a lot of it.
And I think one of my favorite parts about the punk rock scene is just how community oriented it is. You know, we stick up for each other, especially as maybe a more marginalized genre of music. And you touch on that in the book. You know, you talk about guys getting in fights and, oh, run back to the bar and we'll get all our guys. And, you know, then it's a huge brawl in the street.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I think back in those days, especially when I talk to the older guys, they remember when they'd just be walking down the street and get accosted by people for the way they looked, and people would want to pick fights with them, and they'd have to band together just for safety. And the same goes for putting on shows. No bar or club would be interested in this type of music. So what they would do is they just have house parties or rent maybe a rental hall, and they put on their own shows, and they'd invite their band, their friends' bands, and they'd have a bill with 5-6 bands, charge $2 or $3, and they were a lot more active than people probably realize, you know?
Yeah, and I think it's funny, too, how some things don't change. I feel like that is still very much the case a lot of punk music. It's a lot of just, hey, let's get our bands. Let's find a place we can be loud, and we'll charge $5 at the door.
Right. The punk bands were like, well, nobody's ever going to be interested in this. Let's just do our own thing. Let's do it this weekend. We'll do it right away. My friends just started a band. Let's invite them over, you know, and it's a scene. That's how a scene starts.
It kind of comes with the territory. And I think in the book, you do a great job of kind of relaying what it feels like to be at a lot of those gigs or to hear these oral histories of like, oh, yeah, I mean, you know, whatever. Johnny broke his guitar through the PA and then barfed all over his amp. What is your maybe, I guess, favorite gig? Your fondest or most notable gig memory that you just will be with you until the end?
I think the first one I ever went to was probably the most memorable for me, right? I had been into punk rock since I was maybe about 12 years old. So we're talking like early 80s. But it wasn't until I got into high school in the late 80s that I started going to gigs, because there were no other kids that I knew that were into the music, right? So I just kind of enjoyed the music by myself. So there was one. The first one I ever went to was in Chinatown, and it was underground, and it was actually a converted laser tag kind of place. And they just invited punk bands into this laser tag facility. And that was my favorite. Yeah, that's got to be one of my favorite. But there was also one that you'll read in the book that happened at Club Hubba Hubba, which was probably the most infamous strip club in Honolulu and existed for decades. And there was a couple of gigs that were put on there that invited punk rock bands there. So that was really interesting to be in high school and be in the most infamous strip club in Honolulu at the time. Like, wow, I wouldn't have ever been able to get into this place. So this is Club Hubba Hubba. Oh, okay.
And I think, you know, just kind of wrapping it up, it takes a lot to be into punk because people don't look at it super fondly, or it's kind of a complicated thing to be in. So why are you into punk? Why did you get into punk rock music, into punk rock culture? I mean, what was the main driving force behind that?
I still get the same feeling listening to it as I did when I was 12 years old. Like, it's just loud, fast music that is probably the most rebellious form of music you could ever be into. And, you know, they say the music that you get into between the ages of 12 and 16 stick with you for life. So it's never left me. I mean, I love it. And I love all the music that sprouted from it, all the post-punk and all of the new wave and, you know, all the alternative rock. Everything that sprouted from punk rock, it has been such great music and, you know, just given me something to enjoy besides all the mainstream stuff that's force-fed to you through life.
That was The Conversation's Kevin Allen and Sean Lopez, author of Local Unrest. The book is available online and at Skullface Books and Vinyl on Bethel Street.
Jason Ubai. I'm a managing editor in the news department, and I do news stuff. I've been reading and just finished up Haruki Murakami's book. It's What I Talk About When I Talk About Running, which is a very fascinating memoir from the novelist, the Japanese novelist. So it actually starts on Kauai. He's over in Honolulu, and he's running, and he's like, yeah, my publisher told me to write a book about running as a memoir, and so that's what he did. And for me, it resonated that it's been a long time since I've gone running long distance, but what are good exercises that refills your cup and helps you get through your day-to-day and fits your lifestyle? Trying to find those other things that might be lifelong passions that are good and healthy for you.
My name is Jin, and I am a digital news producer and audio producer upstairs in the newsroom here at HPR. I have been reading most recently a collection of Stephen King short stories. I just found them at a local bookstore for like a dollar. One of them was called Nightmares and Dreamscapes, and then this one's called Something About an Evil Monkey. They've been fun to just go through like junk food. I'd recommend this for anyone who's like me, who hasn't read anything and needs to start somewhere. I truly have not read anything for pleasure since I was in like high school. So if you want to get back into reading, you can't go wrong with the classics, I guess.
When Erzi Kubapalko said she loves Ohia, we didn't know if she was talking about the tree or her dog. She's the author of Under the Ohia Tree, a book that teaches readers about Hawaii's native forest species, including manu, birds, kahuli, native snails, insects, and other plants that create a vibrant ecosystem alongside the Ohia Tree. Palko spoke with The Conversation's Lillian Song about the book earlier this year. It's a result of years of studying plants while hiking and teaching performing arts and science.
The inspiration from the book came from hiking in the forest in a rainstorm and just this bizarre sort of outburst of singing that happened spontaneously where I just started singing that song. Under the ohia tree, a little leaf said, breathe with me. And it kept going and kept going. And I was saying the silliest things just to make myself laugh while I was sprinting through the mud and rain to get back to the car with my dog. And when I got back, I basically just had this string of silly things, you know, under the ohia tree, a little leaf said, breathe with me. A bundle of arrow roots said, drink in the mist with me. The ropey roots said, hug the earth with me. All those things, but they're just about ohia trees, which are my favorite tree. And so I did a mock-up and I told my mom about it and showed her my little sketches. And her reaction was, that's nice, Urs, but it's really boring. It needs some animals. And then that kind of snowballed into what it is now, which is an attempt at being a pretty thorough sort of introduction to the main families of animal species that are in the forest along with the ohia trees. So she's been a guiding voice in this whole process.
Yay, Mom. I'm picturing you running through the deluge and singing to yourself. Mm. And when you pick up the book, there's these textured roots of the ohia tree. As you turn into the book, it's so vibrant. There are different animals, different creatures, different parts of the natural world. Your greatest joy is connecting with the earth. Mm. And I really enjoyed how, like, you shared this note to your readers. May each visit to the forest open your heart, sight, and hearing to more and more beloved beings.
Well, thank you for noticing that. I feel very seen by it. I'm not loud about this part of it, but I will say that I pray a lot when I do any art project, and this book was no exception. It was very prayerful. I really put that intention there that anyone that came in contact with this book, that it really would inspire them to be out more with their family, making the time to visit with these precious beings. They're really miraculous that they've held on in spite of everything that we as humans have thrown at them. Maybe the difficult part of writing this book, it's actually related to when my mom told me that this book was really boring since it didn't have any animals. I just sort of knew that Abapane and Amakihi and Elepayo were the more known species, and I had sort of thought they were on all the islands, but I wasn't sure. So I illustrated that page, and then I went to the fantastic deal on our website and was researching what birds are left. And I was pretty devastated to learn that we only had 20 species of small forest birds left on the main islands. There are a few up in the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, but on the main islands, we just had 20 left. And that in my lifetime, there were iiwi birds on Mount Ka'ala, at least, when I was younger. But by the time I started writing the book, they hadn't been seen in 10 years up there. And it ripped my heart out to learn that. And so I thought, okay, there's only 20. I'm going to squeeze them all in here because everybody has to know about what's left here. You know, there were over 60 different small bird species on the main Hawaiian Islands, and now we're down to 20. I cried a lot, actually. So there was this urgency where I thought, okay, I love ohia trees, and if I'm going to bother people with looking at a children's book that I create, I don't want anyone else to grow up the way I did, not knowing what we had here before it was gone.
There are so many layers in this book. There's that narrative voice, and visually, there's a bounty of characters, but there are two main characters.
I'm assuming you're referring to the dog, you know, the reddish-brown dog with the white nose and white throat and white tip of her tail that's bouncing around throughout many of the pages. And that's definitely an avatar of my super puppy, who's been my ride or die hiking buddy in the forest for the past 11 years. The other being is a young child, and I just wanted it to be a young papa kid who's mixed everything, just like all of my friends were growing up and are. I suppose it could be like maybe a representation of my inner child, you know, going around and observing things, because that's what this book is, an expression of my experience in the forest, connecting with these majestic trees and the absolute joy of getting to meet a native species that I've never met before. I don't mean it for it to be me. I mean it for that child in this book to be every child.
This is your first picture book for Keiki. What else have you published?
I also have a coloring book of rhymes. I wanted to create one for Hawaii Island since it's so special that we have Kilauea, the active volcano here. So I worked on that. And one of my best friends, who's an elementary school teacher in California, I think I showed her some of the images from it, and she dared me to write rhymes for each one. I just rolled my eyes and I said, I'm not a writer. I'm not doing that. But then I thought, you know what? I'll just try. And it actually ended up being really fun. I was encouraged, actually, in my foray into writing rhymes by my favorite author of all time, or one of them, J.R.R. Tolkien. So when I was doing some plant science research and weighing a bunch of olena or turmeric that was kind of boring, or, you know, weeding in the olena patches, I would play The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings and listen for hours. What struck me was how many silly rhymes are in Tolkien's writing. I mean, every single character you can think of, the hobbits, the humans, the elves, the goblins, they all sing really silly rhymes throughout the entire epic. And so I thought to myself, you know, I have no calling to write an epic tale, but he seems to be having fun writing these rhymes, so I'm going to keep trying at this. And sure enough, it's fun.
Is there anything that I did not ask you that you would love to like share with our listeners?
I think the main thing is that there was so much that went into this book that was by the grace of other people. Not only my mom giving so much feedback from the beginning, I tasked myself with reading practically every, or at least skimming through practically every published paper about ohia trees that I could find on Google Scholar. And then also was really specifically looking for scientific papers about insects and other native species that would be found in the forest that are common in ohia trees, so that I wasn't just putting out there my experience, but that I was gathering wisdom from the scientific community about that. And so if I found information about species I was unfamiliar with, I reached out to researchers. So many were kind enough to allow me to use some of their research photos as reference photos to sketch some of the things in here. A huge blessing, for example, was Dr. David Shiso of the Snail Extinction Prevention Lab, who allowed me to use reference photos of the kahuli, the land snails. Also, Dr. Noreen Young from the Bishop Museum, who gave me some really critical feedback about the use of the word tree snail versus land snail and the importance of everyone knowing that there are also snails that will live in the leaf litter. Also, from when I was young, I remember watching Hawaii Born of Fire. It's still my favorite documentary about the ecology of the Hawaiian Islands ever. But in there, there's a researcher, Dr. Rosemary Gillespie, who researches spiders. So I dared myself to even reach out to her, because her papers are it when it comes to the research about Native Hawaiian spiders. She and her husband, Dr. George Roderick, allowed me to use some of their research photos as reference photos to have some hidden spiders throughout the book too. Another really cool story is that there's a page with a nest with e'ivi bird chicks in it. And I knew I wanted to draw e'ivi bird chicks, but I couldn't find any photographs of them. So I couldn't ask anyone for a reference photo because I wasn't seeing any anywhere in books or online. So originally, for a long time, that nest was just empty. And I decided, well, I can just make the e'ivi birds building a nest since I can't find a picture of what these chicks look like. But after a while of looking at it, it was so disappointing to have a nest there and not have chicks in it. So I found a description of what e'ivi bird chicks look like in a book called Hawaiian Bird Life by Andrew Berger, and painted up a version. And I thought, okay, well, this looks like what he's describing. And so put it out there, and the book got vetted by the Brett Nainoa Mossman, who's very active with ornithology in the state. And he looked at it and told the publisher, no, that's not what Evie Bird Chicks looks like. She needs to make this darker and color this beak differently and do this and that. So I got notes from Brett about how to redo the Evie Bird Chicks so that they look legitimate. And I finished the draft that's in there now, and they showed it to him and he gave it the thumbs up. So thanks to Brett and Ainoa Mossman, there's a visual representation of Evie Bird Chicks that people can see now. So it's definitely been a team effort, and I'm really forever grateful to everybody who contributed so generously to the creation of this book.
That was writer and illustrator Erzi Kuba-Palko and HPR's Lillian Song back in January. Palko's cakey book, Under the Ohia Tree, is available at local bookstores and online.
My name is D.W. Gibson, and I am the executive producer of podcast and multimedia, and I am an alum of The Conversation proudly. So I've read a few things, but there's one book that really stood out to me. It's an older memoir. It's almost 40 years old. It's called Fierce Attachments by Vivian Gornick. It's just an amazing book. I am not a sort of prime memoir reader. It's not my bag usually. But this one kept getting recommended to me over and over again, and I was really intrigued by Vivian Gornick's work, so I thought I would dive in, and it is just spectacular. And you know, it does that thing that I think good memoirs are supposed to do, where it tells a very specific story about a very specific relationship, but it's told so well and so expansively that it really could be about so many things, about so many facets of family relationships. I think any parents and kids could recognize themselves in the dynamics that are described, just packed with humanity, page after page.
My name is Kelsey Armstrong, and I am a board operator here at HPR. This summer, I've been reading this novel that was recommended by one of my other coworkers here, Lonnie Lee, called I Who Have Never Known Men by Jacqueline Hartman. Follows the story of a girl born in captivity in like a prison with a bunch of other like older women, and it's kind of like her journey of organizing them and their escape with, you know, no education or knowledge of the outside world. And I feel like as someone who's read a lot of social theory, it was a really interesting fiction novel to read because it kind of brings in some concepts, like philosophical concepts, like Plato's Allegory of the Cave and things like that. So there's some really cool political philosophy, I think, woven into it. And obviously, like, the process of organizing, you know, the people around you for freedom.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Ahana Ho with some of our favorite local authors. Up next, a Hawaiian murder mystery where speaking Olelo Hawaii is enough to cast a spell. The Killing Spell is the debut novel by native Hawaiian author and local TikTok personality Shay Kauwe. Kauwe grew up on Hawaiian homestead land in Waimanalo. Her novel is set in the future, where magic is deeply attached to cultural languages. HPR's Russell Subiono spoke with Kauwe in May.
I read that your book, The Killing Spell, is the first traditionally published adult fantasy novel by a native Hawaiian. That seems to be a huge deal. Congratulations on that. Can you talk about what that means?
I think it's just exciting to be able to write the kinds of stories that I always read, both as a kid, as a teen, as an adult, and to put a twist on them, to put people that I see in my own community, people who are a lot like me, who are like my papa and my nana and my family, all the extended uncles and aunts and those kinds of things, into a book. Because I think it helps people feel seen in a way. I feel seen, you know, and like these big industries kind of going out of their way to find authors to do that. Calla Kendall, who wrote the new Twisted Tales by Disney for Moana. And I know at least in Kiala's case, like they were specifically looking for a Hawaiian writer to write those stories, which is amazing. I'm glad that, you know, there's some attention and some desire and drive to push for our stories written by us. Yeah, sure. Maybe historically that hasn't always been the case. So
so this is your first novel. Can you share a little bit about the story? Maybe just share a little bit with our listeners that kind of maybe just gives them an idea of what's really cool about your novel.
Yeah, I have like two pitch lines, I'll say. If somebody's local, I'm like, it's like if Homestead had magic. Because I grew up on Homestead, and that is entirely like, that was the original seed of thought for me. What if everyone in the Homestead had magic, and what would that look like? And then the other thing is, in a world where each language is its own branch of magic, what does Hawaiian look like in that world? Because I'm a language learner of Olalo Hawaii, relatively new to it. And it was kind of like top of mind when I was writing this as well.
Yeah. Only recently have I started hearing stories kind of like magic within our Hawaiian culture. In your experience and things you've read or things you've heard from your kupuna, how much magic is there in our culture?
I think people in Hawaii and Native Hawaiians too kind of have this natural balance with magic existing side by side in the real world. It's very normal and natural here, but I think for other people, it might be a little bit weird if you're coming from the outside. Like, my grandma is very strictly Catholic, but does she believe in ghosts? Yes. Is she going to do anything to like piss off Pele when we go to Big Island? Absolutely not. Like, there is just this natural balance of both those worlds existing side by side. And I think I feel that too in a lot of ways. Although I personally don't have a lot of experiences with the spiritual world, whatever you might want to call it, the magical world. Like, my great grandmother was somewhat attuned to that. I actually live in her house now, but it was never something that was questioned. You just sort of respect what they say and do what they say if they tell you to do something. Yeah. So no specific stories about like night marchers or menehune or anything like that, but more just this general understanding that it is real and should be respected side by side, modern day beliefs.
Here's one of the many things that I find interesting about your book and really any story that includes magic. Spells don't always work the way the person casting the spell wants them to, right? In your book, you write, magic was finicky. It didn't like giving away things for free. Mm-hmm. And it must be so frustrating to be a wizard or a sorcerer or a spellsmith, like in your book. Why is magic like this? Why can't it just be more compliant?
I thought about that. I think of magic in my book as a skill. So much like language learning, because that's really like the basis for what it does. And it doesn't always do what you want when you want it. Everybody has a story of like trying to say something, it coming out wrong, mm-hmm. everyone laughing or making a bad situation worse. And I just wanted that to be reflected in my book. So it's like a fun fact. Anytime a spell goes wrong, it is something that personally frustrates me about that language that I get wrong a lot. I personally struggle with Hawaiian pronouns, which is, it should be easy. It's mm-hmm. like a very simple thing. And I, to this day, mess them up all the time. So that's why it's in there.
And your book is really an interesting weaving of ideas, right? It's clearly fantasy with magic as a very strong component, but there's also some like post-apocalyptic vibes, some very strong cultural and language underpinnings, and some clear socioeconomic themes as well. Mm-hmm. When you think about all the things that your book touches on, where did the idea for your book come from?
I don't think it's any one thing. Like, I think any book is sort of a mishmash of all these different influences that have impacted the author's life. I also think I, like many debut authors, am maybe guilty of making my main character a little bit too much like me and this world a little bit too much like my own. So it's very close to my heart in that way. But the real trigger, I think, was, you know, I grew up in the homestead. I thought it was small and boring and it didn't fit. There weren't a lot of people who enjoyed the things that I enjoyed. I wanted to move out. And much to my parents' concern, I moved across the world for a man to Russia.
that's really far.
That's far. They were not thrilled with that. And I started learning Russian by necessity. And a couple years into it, I realized like I could speak Russian better than I could speak Hawaiian. And that was like a, I don't know, a light bulb moment where I was like, what is the excuse that I have? I used to say I was bad at languages, like they were so hard, I could never do it. And I'd done it unintentionally, not perfectly, of course, but I didn't have shame when speaking Russian because it was like a survival thing. I just needed to do it. So it didn't matter if I was making mistakes. And I realized if I went home and I applied that same concept, I could probably make some decent progress in Hawaiian too.
What did you find was the biggest help for you in learning Russian that you could apply to learning Hawaiian? Did it have to do with immersion? Did it have to do with, you know, having someone to constantly converse with?
I actually think it's the difference between them because I do think it's immersion. So when I came back as an adult, incredibly difficult to find an immersive Hawaiian environment just because of the historical implications of Hawaiian. Like short of moving to Niihau or a very small place in Molokai, where also you kind of have to be invited in, right? It's not cool to just show up and like insert yourself into people's lives. It was really, really challenging and it still is challenging for me. And I think some of that unfairness around what history has done to the Hawaiian language to make it so inaccessible and difficult, even for those who are interested in learning, is something I wanted to showcase. It's all my own frustrations rolled into a book.
I can't let you go without asking you about TikTok. Mm-hmm. You have over 31,000 followers, which is pretty significant, I think. What does it mean to you as a storyteller to have an audience like that?
I don't know what to say about social media because my original videos on TikTok, I was just honestly talking about the idea of the book and people were interested, but I really didn't start to gain followers until I started making my opinions about things like colonization, very well known, controversy picks up on social media platforms and it's sort of grown that audience.
What was it like for you on the day that you got your first copy?
So funny, I didn't get my first copy. I'll get them on Monday. I bought this at Barnes & Noble.
Oh, you bought your own book?
Because it got shipped to the stores before it got shipped to me. I think with every milestone, as exciting as it is, I just see what is ahead. Like the goalposts keep moving. But for me, that's exciting because it's momentum to never really stop. Like I am so excited for this book to be out in the world, for people to read it, and to hopefully be inspired to relearn their own mother tongue, whatever that may be. I think it applies beyond Olelo Hawaii as well. But I'm also excited for what I see on the horizon, like the next thing. I can talk about this. I can. Like my next book is sort of secured with the publisher and I'm looking forward to that. So I guess what I would say to people who are listening is to not stop and not get discouraged because it doesn't really end. And that is a good thing. It is exciting to keep going forward in this industry.
Yeah. Love the process. Yeah.
Yes,
process, yeah.
It is. Like that's the enjoyable part, the struggle.
Well, Shae Kawe, thanks so much for your time today. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, thank you, Russell. Thanks for having me.
That was author Shae Kawe talking with HPR's Russell Subiono. Kawe's debut novel, The Killing Spell, is available in bookstores and online. This summer, Kawe will be at the 84th World Science Fiction Convention in Anaheim before returning to Hawaii Island for a meet and greet at Kohala Public Library. You'll find more information on her website, shaekawe.com.
My name is Kevin Allen. I'm a producer for The Conversation, so I help the show run and do some stories. What have I been reading really for the past 2 years is an exploration into a universe of fiction called the Warhammer 40K fiction. It's set 40,000 years into the future. It's a grim, dark universe. It's very It's very dark, it's very morbid, but it's fun and I really enjoy it. There's a lot of history to all the characters. It's kind of a political intrigue in a world that is incredibly developed and complex. I enjoy these books a lot because it's just a complete departure from what we would think of as human civilization.
I am Bill Dorman. I work in the news department. I'm executive editor and, do a little thing called The Asian Minute as well. One book that I wanted to highlight because it was fun and interesting is Desi Arnaz's memoirs, which he originally wrote in 1976, and they published an updated version this year with his daughter Lucy had contributions, and they had some other material from his papers. There's a lot about television that's just sort of interesting and fun, and if you're into celebrity things and film gossip of the time, there are some things there. But for me, really, that aspect of media is fascinating. And just as business models for me are blowing up all around the world now, and they were at that time as well.
Of Change is the title of a book that looks at women taking the lead and doing more to become food secure. Monique Morinesco is the author and a University of Hawaii professor. We met with her at Ho'ili'ili Market last Christmas. It's a retail outlet for FarmLink, a food hub which is mentioned in the book. Morinesco points to the market as the place where it all comes together.
I've been teaching a class called Politics of Food at West Oahu since 2007, and it requires service learning. And so we go to different community partners and do agricultural work. So whatever they happen to need, we go as a class. So generally we will pull weeds or invasive species. We'll go to Ma'o Farms or we'll go to Pai Pai Eoheia and move rocks or help cut their mangroves back. Or we used to go to Kokua Hawaii Foundation's garden beds at different schools to help build the garden beds or weed or do whatever they happen to need. Now we go to the Kokua Learning Farm and do some agricultural work there. And so I noticed that the people who were doing the leadership work and taking this kind of work on in these community partners were really mostly women. And so I thought, I think there's something there. My background is in feminist theory. That's what I got my PhD in Manoa. And so I thought I could put these two things together and do some research and really learn about what endeavors are out there. And so I feel like it's my responsibility as an academic to use my privilege to help amplify these stories and also figure out how they are connected. And so what does our food system transformation look like? What are the things that are going well? What are the opportunities? What are the challenges? And so I wove all the stories together. I did 29 interviews here in Hawaii, 19 in New Zealand. And I decided to sort of show how things are the same and things are different, two different colonized places, two different colonizers, and two different responses. I had a bit of a hiccup with the pandemic where I was almost stuck in Aotearoa. I made it home and then I was supposed to go to Tahiti. I never went because of the pandemic, so I just decided to write it up before the data got too outdated. The stories of the women who are doing this work are incredible. We've got people who are interested in compost, women who are working in education or in public health or nutrition, farmers, lawyers, lobbyists, all kinds of different people, you know, sustainability coordinators, project leads in a variety of community partners like the Ulu Co-op, for example. And I hit all of the different islands except for Kauai, although there are plenty of interesting examples of women doing great work there, like Waipaua Foundation.
And we're sitting here at the Farmlick retail store. And this is kind of where it all comes together, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. So one of the arguments of the book, or the conclusions, if you will, is that we need to, one, decolonize our food systems, lessen the imports, and two, look to indigenous food systems to re-regionalize our food systems. And what a better way to do it than a food hub? And this happens to be the retail arm of Farmlink. They have been connecting growers and consumers for, I don't know how long they've been open, I think since 2016 or something like that. But that's a really great example of a system that works, that helps connect, you know, and it reduces waste. It helps connect people to local food, local products, understanding about seasonality, and yeah, decolonizing agriculture so that we are not dependent on the continent or international sources for our food.
I interfaced with the Ulu Cooperative several years ago, and that was just amazing to see how much they've expanded over a short time, trying to get the volume up, right, to do what they want to do, create flour, get in schools, and they're doing that.
It's amazing work. And again, it's the testament to the women doing the work, right? Because it really is mostly women. It's not to say that there are not great men doing good work out there. It's just that I've found that the people at the leadership level were women, and they're looking to make connections, to understand how they can help each other. It's not a competition for grants, for example. Everybody's like, how can we work together? How can we collaborate? So there is a danger to essentialist notion of women are inherently better at that. That's not what I found. I found that women were willing to do this kind of work and not take all the glory for themselves. I think that understanding that we come from an assets-based perspective, right? What do we have that's good, that's working? And let's run with that. Let's do more with that rather than only focusing on the negatives, the chronic diseases, the poverty, wealth inequality. Those are all there, don't get me wrong. But I think there are also amazing things going on in these various communities led by women in these community partnerships or community organizations. That is great.
And with women, I know there tends to be a lot of support and just a desire to help the other person.
Absolutely. Yeah, again, I think it has to do with an attitude or an ethic of collaboration rather than an ethic of competition and getting the recognition. I think there's less of an emphasis on recognition and more of an emphasis on making sure the work gets done, putting your head down and just doing the work.
Is there anything that surprised you? I don't know if there were differences between here in Hawaii and in New Zealand.
Yeah, so I think we have more of a structure where we as a society are using nonprofits to get work done in this space. And they have a political-legal system with the Treaty of Waitangi where Maori are given certain rights and the iwi settlements and all these things. And so they have an ability to use that to get things done. Iwi, that's the word for large tribe in Maori, are given back either money or land. We don't have that. That hasn't really happened here. And they've been able to use that structure to reshape their food systems. So their food system is different. They don't import nearly as much, though they do. They export most of their food. And so the idea is we should be feeding ourselves, and we should be doing that here as well. And so they, for example, are a really large dairy producer, right? Which has all kinds of really problematic environmental impacts, right? These huge cattle ranches, dairy cattle ranches, and have all kinds of deleterious impacts on the environment, on the soil, on the waterways, etc. So they take the milk, they ship it to China, they make powder out of it, and then they sell it back to New Zealand for baby formula. So it's that same story that we've had here in the past with beef, for example. We grow the beef here, then it goes somewhere else for it to be finished and then comes back. I don't think that's the case any longer because now we have slaughterhouse capacity. So it's the same kind of idea. It just doesn't seem to make sense.
What do you hope people will get out of your book as they read these stories?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things. There are still major challenges, land ownership patterns here in Hawaii, still with that sort of plantation mentality where it's like large landowners are only willing to sell to other large landowners. And there are issues. The entry level is so high in terms of capital that it's impossible for young people to farm. So I think understanding how to get more young people into farming, how to grow and distribute. Again, we're here at FarmLink, right? So grow and distribute local food to local people, regardless of their ability to afford it, right? Because that's a huge thing too, right? Local food tends to be more expensive, labor costs are higher, et cetera. So I think that the stories really reflect the work that's being done to push that forward. And I think that also talking, everybody's got to eat, right? So I think food is a really great way to lean into conversations about inequality, about colonization, about valuing indigenous food systems and combining them with scientific approaches to agriculture, sustainable agriculture. And so valuing that indigenous agriculture as science.
So it's really kind of reclaiming the power of food.
Absolutely. And like I said, everyone's got to eat, but food is not only central to our lives, but it's central to our cultures, respective cultures, right? Diverse cultures. It's central to our families. It's central to women's roles in the home, outside the home. So I think it's a really great entry point into having a bunch of might otherwise be uncomfortable conversations about inequality, about access, about environmental justice and food justice.
That was Monique Marinesco, author of the book Seeds of Change, which looks at the roles of women in Hawaii and New Zealand in the food sovereignty movement. That wraps it up for today. Got feedback for us? Maybe some thoughts on the books we shared? Or do you know an author who has a book coming out soon? Share your comments or questions by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can email us too at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and Kevin Allen. Our intern is Addis Bulai. Additional support from the HBR digital team. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.